Hi, everybody. So welcome to this live Q&A session for the New Music Shelf Vocal Anthologies thing. I'm Dennis Tabensky. I'm New Music Shelf, basically. And I'm here tonight. Laura, I always get the order of your last names wrong.
It's just Laura Strickling.
Isn't it? Oh, Laura Strickling is fine. Okay, Laura Strickling, our soprano curator, and Megan Enan, our mezzo-soprano curator. Our baritone, Michael Kelly, might join us later. I don't think he can make it, but if he pops in, awesome. So, and by the way, I am also the tenor volume curator. So we have some extra people. Roland is a composer who's also joining us tonight. So I have a whole list of questions here that people have sent in via email. Hopefully people will... Roland is a composer who's... this is the fun part. Sorry, I just heard my own voice in my ears since I have the live chat window up. The joys of live chatting and stuff. So, yeah, we're going to answer some questions about... and clarify some stuff about the Colfer scores so you guys know as much as possible. So do you... Laura, Megan, do you want to jump in and say anything before we do any question answering?
Sure, I'll start. I'm excited about these anthologies because I think that it's a great way for us to kind of, well, anthologize, catalog some new art song that's happening and get it to a wider audience. So by being able to bring these kind of groupings of art song together and then being able to share that with other voice teachers or other singers, we're kind of making that connection between composer groups and singer groups a little bit more fluid, I think.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the main reasons that I'm very, very excited about this. And when Dennis and I started talking about the project overall, that I know that he's really thought about how to make this a win-win situation for everyone involved. And so it feels like something that is good to get on board with, because I want those kinds of situations to happen for performers and composers, that we can be creative and come up with ways to put composers' music out in the world and to get singers, like get their music into the hands of singers while everyone is doing it in a sustainable way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my piece.
Awesome. Yeah. That's my goal with this. I'll end up like blathering a bit tonight about some of the why certain things are the way they are. And it's basically to hope to make this like the best it can be for singers, for composers. We actually even have, my original plan for this was to have, and we'll talk about this more later, just self-published composers be a part of this. But, I've actually had some composers be a part of it or like already submit some things, who are published by traditional publishers, and their publishers are like thrilled to have them be a part of what's going on here. So I think, that's like another added level of win when like big publishers are like, yeah, this is cool. We want to be a part of this. And not just sort of, originally I was sort of ready to be like to stay in the self-publishing ghetto, but this is definitely going to be beyond that. So that's awesome.
That's great.
So shall we jump into some questions here?
Does Laura want to say
anything? Laura, do you have anything?
I mean, I really just feel the same way Megan did. And I'm always looking for new songs, and I'm always looking for new composers, and it can be really hard to access new things. Mm-hmm. And so it's a no-brainer. And when Dennis contacted me, the more he talked about it, the more excited I got. And his passion for it is really exciting too, because it's exactly what you want. The vision he has is exactly what you want in the music world. You want people who are coming up with ways to help other people. And we're all looking, we all have the same goals. And it's kind of this perfect, to use a business term, it's very synergistic.
Well, you know, that fits.
So thank you, Dennis, because it's a fantastic idea, and I'm surprised no one has come up with it yet.
Oh, mm-hmm. I feel like this used to be more of a thing, probably more within a publisher. Like, there used to be anthologies. I know, like, I've looked around, you know, for examples of this. And we all know the 24 Italian songs and arias, but that's old. Like, that's been around forever. There's also the Singer's Anthology of Musical Theater, which, you know, I don't know if that's still going on or not. I just know there's 1.5 billion volumes of it out there. And, you know, that's a specific thing, and that's, it's great. I've seen...
Well, there are some for 20th century song, and you know, when I was an undergrad, those were really useful to me.
Yeah.
But we're not in the 20th century anymore.
Exactly, yeah. and I sort of feel like those came out in, like, the 80s and 90s. Like, this hasn't been done for a good long while. And I suspect that they tended to be very, like... My example is always Boosie. Like, Boosie would put out one that had Boosie composers, and Shermer would put out one that had Shermer composers. Stuff like that, where there wasn't cross-pollination. Here, like, New Music Shelf isn't technically a publisher, so, like, it's mainly a distributor. This actually turns it into a publisher, and that's its own thing. But, like, there's the possibility that we might have some stuff from, like, E.C. Shermer and, you know, other publishers in here, which is awesome. And yeah, like, this hasn't been done for a while, so I'm excited.
And one of the most important aspects when you initially approached me about this is the recording, because mm-hmm. I feel like people need to hear something to be convinced, unfortunately. And so if we can just bridge that gap in whatever mm-hmm. small way, and not, it basically, you know, we do a little bit of their job for them. But if the whole point is to make this as like accessible as possible, it's the ultimate way to get your music out there. And I think that, and I know this stands for me, but once I hear something by a composer that I like, mm-hmm. I'm much more likely to seek out what else they've done.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, you might have one song represented in this anthology, but that will lead to singers saying, oh, this guy's amazing. I mm-hmm. love this song. And mm-hmm. looking into his other stuff and recommending stuff, the composer stuff, to, you know, their friends.
Yeah.
This guy or this gal, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or this gal. Yeah. I know. How do I qualify? It's live, folks. We're doing it live.
I know.
We're doing it live.
I will say, I just recorded a CD of, like, female composer stuff, so.
Yes. Nice.
I'm into it.
No. Nice.
We're doing it right, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, jumping into some questions, you think?
Yeah, let's do that. So, one question I've gotten a couple of times, what's the deadline? I actually just made a point of making this much more prominent on the Call for Scores page. It's August 31st of this year, so August 31st, 2017. So you still have 15 days to get stuff in. It's a very easy application. It's just, what songs do you want to send? Give me your name, give me your email, and then make a Dropbox folder or a Google Drive folder. It's really simple. There's some little instructions on how to name your files. But again, very straightforward. It's just so that I can, since I'm administering the whole thing, so that I can get the right songs to the right singers at the end of it. Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi.
so yeah, all the file names, you know, we're just going to make sure that everything's easy, so I can do a search for soprano, and those go into a special folder for Laura, mezzo, special folder for Megan, etc. So that's kind of the big part of the instructions, is how to name your files, and that's all on the page. I'll make sure, actually you can go to newmusicshelf.com/call to find those instructions. That's there. So before we go into more questions, I want to just go into some, like, best practices for some of the submissions. One, read the instructions. I'm a composer. I know how we are. We don't read the instructions. It can be really yeah, interesting, the things that get submitted without having read instructions. I've done many calls for scores in the past. So make sure you just go through them. They're straightforward. They're bullet points. What I like to do when I am applying for an opportunity is I print out the page, and then I go through with a highlighter and say, this line is important, this phrase is important, you know, anonymous entry, which that's not the case here, but if that's a thing, like, you want to know that's important, and, you know, what's the deadline, and what's the file format, you know, that sort of thing. Go through line by line, just make sure you know exactly what the requirements are, not just for this, but for everything. But if you go through these instructions like that, you're going to have no problems. So, do you guys have anything to add to that? No? Okay. So the next set of questions that I tend to get are about voicing and instrumentation. Basically, so this call for scores is for either solo voice or for solo voice and piano. So if you have a piece for two singers and piano, unfortunately, that's not going to fit this particular project. If you have choral works, again, that's not going to fit. But that doesn't mean that these sorts of projects aren't going to happen in the future. I have a lot of plans to, woo! Like, these four volumes are I'm calling it a pilot project, that if these are successful, then New Music Shelf will expand very aggressively outward into instrumental music, into more ensemble type stuff, anything that can be kind of easily marketed to ensembles and to performers. If there's some sort of standard thing that we can do, then I want to get everybody's music out there. Another question I get is, I have a piece for soprano, piano, and horn. Can I submit that? Not for this one. You know, since we're limiting to solo voice and solo voice and piano, additional instruments or instruments other than piano for accompanying, they make it much more difficult to have a cohesive anthology. So if the example I'm using a lot when I talk to Laura and Megan and Michael and any of the composers who email me, I use the 24 Italian songs and arias as my example. When you get that volume, you know exactly what you're getting. You know that it's one voice, it's one piano, and you're not going to have continuo thrown in, or you're not going to have, like, oh, suddenly this one has a guitar, that one requires a cello. You know you have 24 songs that you can perform with a pianist. So that's really the main thing. I mean, this is partly artistic, partly marketing.
It's almost like this is sort of a 21st century almost equivalent to that in terms of aiming for accessibility and stuff.
Yeah, that's really a lot of how I'm thinking about this. It's the beginning of doing that again, and having the 21st century, 24 international art songs and maybe arias.
And we do need that because so much new music is just assumed to be, not always without justification, really inaccessible things to get lost in, very technically difficult. And that scares people away, even quite sophisticated performers. And that's something I was already thinking about from perhaps more of a musical theatre direction, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But there's even more of a need in the sort of the arts and world, especially because there are a lot of teachers who are, I think teachers in particular need this, because there might be a lot that are nervous of introducing things with sort of musical theatre direction, because it might lead in leading into vocal techniques they're not confident with, or especially not confident with for working with young singers. And so having something that's sort of musically, vocal technically in their safer space, but actually safe and accessible.
Yeah.
There's got to be a usage case for that.
Oh, totally. I remember, like, being in undergrad, because I was a voice major, having, like, I've learned that not all schools have this, and that kind of weirds me out. But we had a 20th century or 21st century requirement in the senior recital. The junior recital, it was like slightly, you know, a little bit more lenient. Like there was definitely the English language thing at some point, but at some point you had to have a piece 20th century. And for almost everybody, that was musical theater. And because nobody really knew where to look for the new classical music, you know, from living or recently dead composers. And so I went above and beyond and did a bunch of crazy stuff. But my voice teacher, like, largely relied on Ned Roram's 14 Songs on American Poetry, which is pretty standard and it's great, but it's only 14 songs and it's only one composer. And it's kind of old at this point. And so I know that I would have, as a voice student, I would have really appreciated having more access to the music of living composers. And, you know, I went out and searched for a bunch of stuff and, you know, did recently dead composers mostly, except for Ned. Did a whole concert of Ned. But yeah, part of this actually comes out of seeing on Facebook a question about a voice teacher saying, I would like to program more new music, you know, by living composers. And, you know, I know that there's a whole wide world of self-published composers out there. Where do I find them? How do I get their stuff? So this is very much born out of that question. And knowing that I have a platform of, you know, New Music Shelf and can easily turn that into a publisher, which is what I'm doing. It's sort of a no-brainer to go in that direction and to try and serve those people in a way that they want and that they need. And connecting them to this wide world of wonderful composers who have a lot of great music that falls within the parameters of what we're doing, that, you know, can then blossom from there. So, you know, finding a song by composer X in, you know, The Soprano Volume 1, you can go to the rest of that you can go to that composer's website and find the rest of their vocal music and go from there. And really, you know, as a composer.
Yeah. Dennis, do you think that we could take that opportunity to go through the voice types that are going to be in this round of anthologies?
Yes. Yeah. I'm getting so far like afield, but,
no, it's okay. Bringing you back. Here we go.
Thank you. Thank you. I need it. I blather so much about this.
It's like we run podcasts or something.
I know. Yeah. I know. But usually I'm the one like just asking a simple question and then sitting back and, the voice types for this, soprano, mezzo soprano, tenor, and baritone. And then
future voice types, other voice types potentially in the future, like you have an idea about doing countertenor things, in another cycle of these anthologies.
Yes.
Do you envision that you would be breaking these down by Fach in the future? You had said something about maybe going an instrumental route before that. So do you have any opinions on whether or not this type of anthology breaking down by soprano, alto, tenor, bass would break down farther into that we would be kind of picking for our Fach or for kind of like voice of like holistic mezzo-soprano?
I sort of suspect it'll probably stay a little bit more, you know, soprano, mezzo-soprano. Because that's still fairly, it's broad enough that we can stretch a range on either side. We can, you know, I worry, and this is something that, you know, this is an evolving project. This is round one. We're going to learn a lot from these 80 songs, 80 Ooh. Songs. Woo-hoo. That number always gets me a little awesome. Flustered. We're going to learn a lot from this, and we're going to learn a lot from the feedback that we get from the voice teachers, the students, the professionals, you know, everyone that we market this to and get this to, and we'll get feedback from them. So it may get a little bit more granular. Right now, at this very moment, before the first call for scores is finished and nothing's published yet, there's I'm expecting it to stay somewhat broadly within those specific voice types, adding in absolutely in some around counter tenor, and possibly, I mean, yeah, it's all the input, you know, we'll be getting input about this and we'll be able to make more decisions later. I have absolutely heard specifically about counter tenor, because there's a lot of stuff out there. There are counter tenors out there. They need music.
And maybe we could take that opportunity to talk about things like inside of that, mm-hmm. Amplification or your genre specific, if that's a thing that
that
people are kind of thinking about, like, do I write in the style that is appropriate for this call for scores?
Yeah. Well, actually, I'd like, Laura and Megan, I'd like you to sort of maybe take, I've had a couple people ask, like, okay, so I have a song, it's written, like, my terminology is for alto and piano, or I've somebody for contralto and piano. When it comes to the way that people label things, what's your, and also, I have a thing, high voice, medium high, medium low. What is your take as the curators of this? For that.
Well, I think that there is kind of industry-wide terminology that's accepted. So mm-hmm. I think that soprano, mezzo, tenor, bass makes it's a safe choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're worried about whether or not something is appropriate for soprano or for mezzo, I guess they just make a judgment call. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you're asking people to submit each song one time, correct? Or are they allowed to submit it for both soprano and mezzo?
You can submit it. Like, I have a friend who has a piece. Well, I have my own pieces for just voice and piano that fits kind of mid-range. My thought is you can submit that song once per anthology, you know, once per voice type.
Okay. But don't you agree, Megan, that this is kind of an established industry-wide terminology that makes sense to use?
Yeah, and I think that... because in solo voice, when we're doing soprano, mezzo, tenor, baritone, bass mm-hmm. kind of things, if we split up that way, that in choral repertoire, you'd get that soprano alto. So if you're mm-hmm. calling it alto, mm-hmm. that's mezzo. So that within that, if you are really specific that it's a contralto piece, then I'm probably less likely to consider that as part of like my little purview of the mezzo soprano anthology, because mm-hmm. if it really is a contralto piece, then that should be in its own contralto mm-hmm. area. Unless you're kind of like, no, it like straddles that line. A mezzo that's kind of exploring contralto rep might be mm-hmm. interested in this. Then that's the place where I would cap that. If it's like, nope, this is very clearly contralto, mm-hmm. then I'm like, oh yeah, that's like when they do a contralto and countertenor and stuff like that anthology.
Yeah. The thing that I've typically said is, if the song as you've written it fits into one of these voice types, into the general range, which is, you know, you can look up the basic range on Wikipedia and say, like, that's safe. If the song fits that, or if, you know, only like barely goes out of it, then you're pretty safe. If it's something that doesn't quite fit there, but that you're comfortable transposing, then do that.
For instance, like if I get a song that's for, say, high coloratura that mm-hmm. has like F's in it, like I can't sing F's, but I certainly have friends.
Yeah.
So
right.
Then they have breath that is like, you know, sparkly and high and can do all that fun stuff. So it's not gonna be, can I sing this? It's going to be, would I want my soprano friends to know about this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the problem, though, Laura, is like, or not the problem, but the question,
mm-hmm.
which is, if we're doing this in a way where we're going to make the recordings that go with it, are you then farming out that recording to other people? Like, probably. If you have one song in that anthology that's coloratura, is that going to be done by, you know, fill in favorite coloratura here?
Catherine Bruton would probably be the type who'd be up for this.
Yeah, like I don't have a problem with that at all. Yeah. I don't have a problem with that, especially because I don't think we, you know, I when I go through saying, you know, does this song that I'm judging right now, does it feature what I do well, or, you know, I want to judge them based on their own merits, not just based on how I would sing them. So if there's something that's just I cannot physically do because it doesn't make sense, then I'm sure we can come up with a solution for
it. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. While we're on the topic of
range, and also I think tessitura is going to be seeing fit, I think we should definitely put in the score, put in the book or somewhere that's very clear in the publishing what the range of each piece is. I know that Ross already does this with all of his vocal pieces, but I think that tessitura is quite significant. And one thing that I've found that I've actually used with when sending a draft score to a friend who wanted to check is this going to be okay with her, is that I literally used link in the chat, which intended for piano pieces, literally showing a frequency diagram of each key getting pressed, and you can use that for just the vocal line, and it will show a distribution of like whereabouts in the range it is, because that's because it's like, it's one thing, oh, it goes up to a C, and quite another thing is say, oh, it's basically half the pieces, A's and B's just below that.
Yeah, right.
Which I'm sure Laura has dealt with that in new music. I'm like, nope.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I totally see putting range and tessitura, like being really clear about where these sit in the score. That's a pretty easy analysis to do and put in the score so that we a teacher can say, this is appropriate for this student of mine, or a singer says, this is appropriate for me. That's not appropriate for me.
Yeah, and just having, and I think the advantage of sort of that sort of diagrammatic approach is that you can see at a glance, so this is how many of this note there is, which is potentially significant in terms of singers working through passaggio. They can see like where, like if there's like say lots of E flats and E's or whatever, and they but their passaggio is at a C, then that might be easier than if it was on an E flat or whatever. So that's what part of what made me think a lot of the an advantage of the diagrammatic approach is that you can put all of that into something that would take a couple of hundred words to describe. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really useful thing, and there is a and the use of it is licensed under an attribution non-commercial Creative Commons license. There's a link on a little license link on there. So that's something that would be, I think, potentially very handy for sort of a visual representation range. In the same way, like I've seen some of the little like pop music books that just show the highest and lowest notes, but just having something lit something visual like that is a really good way of potentially showing that teachers could say refer to in more detail and think, this one for my single with passaggio around E flat would be a little more awkward for performing, but useful for working around that. But this one doesn't really have any of those notes, so that say it's in a say it's in C major or whatever, and it doesn't have E flats and then it doesn't have many E's for whatever reason. It's like, well, yeah, that would be easier for that singer, so we can do that. And those are the sort of decisions that you can make quicker with that, rather than just care like spending 5 minutes per bar like checking like everything.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, David. Yeah
I like that.
Well, just in general, like when you're preparing your scores, I don't know about you guys, but like, I like to know, we definitely want to know who your poet is. So that should be like right up there with your name.
Oh yeah.
And if the music, or if the poem or the text is excerpted from a larger work, I want to know. So like I did this piece by Amy Beth Kirsten that's from Hamlet. And at the top of the score, she has, you know, Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 2, or whatever, I think Scene 1. Because, again, as someone who would potentially sing your work, I may be looking to program a Shakespeare recital. And if it's right there in front of me, I can see immediately all the information I need to know to make decisions.
Or you can broader context of if it's within an excerpt, to be a way in of getting a connection with the text. That's already a...
Yeah, totally.
Yep. What's next, Dennis?
You mentioned the idea of amplification electronics, stylistic things. We've gone back and forth on this. The curators and I am a curator, so not and I, just the curators. We talked a little bit about amplification, and essentially what we've come to is like going back to the 24 Italian songs and arias. We want to make sure that everything is like, you know exactly what you're getting, so that you're not coming into the thing and suddenly there's a piece with required amplification. I've made it, you know, my initial thing that I said to everybody in our little private conversation was, I don't mind if it's optional amplification. I think that's totally great. If the piece doesn't require it, that's fine. If it's something required, the issue I have is kind of manifold. For this particular volume, one, it comes down to, you know, the Sesame Street. One of these things is not like the other. It's a bit of a surprise potentially for someone buying it. And as the company that is putting this out, I need to make sure that these are trustworthy, that we're not throwing curveballs at anybody. So, if I were to be buying this and I found like, oh, in the middle of it, there's a piece that requires amplification and I didn't know that, I wouldn't trust the publications as much going forward. So on a business sense, I need to be cognizant of that. On an artistic sense, these, you know, should, we're sticking kind of to acoustic sorts of things. But if amplification is optional, fine. Also, when it comes to just the logistics of it, a required amplification, that means that there's equipment, there's someone to set it up, someone to maybe, you know, run it, someone to tear it down, you know, potential rental costs. Like there's so much in that that's not the sort of thing you get with, this is for voice and piano. So that's sort of many places where I'm coming from with that particular thing. And we've all sort of come to Jesus on that one. electronics, not for this volume, required amplification, not for this volume, optional amplification. That is something that we will absolutely entertain. One thing that, you know, I said as well in this conversation, I am much more excited about putting out a later volume or seven of works with electronics, with amplification, with all these things that are 21st century and new and exciting and put, you know, really where a lot of the art form is going in many ways. I'm much more excited about doing a publication or, you know, again, seven, dedicated to that. Sure. And keeping things much more separate and much more marketing friendly. I mean, yeah. Well, you know, some of this just comes down to dollars and cents. As then questions about improvisation, I'm willing to entertain it. I think it's not the hardest sell in the world, but I'm willing to go there. I think we're all willing to go there. If what you're asking for is well documented, it's clear what you're looking for, you know, your score is clear, go for it. Mm-hmm. I did get a question just yesterday. Someone's saying, you know, I'm more of a singer-songwriter. It's much more poppy. My stuff isn't really necessarily notated. I'm going to have a little bit more problem with the not necessarily notated thing, because that's a lot, again, in terms of cohesion, in terms of readability, in terms of marketing, that becomes slightly more difficult proposition. And when, again, one of these things is not like the other, in a way that's really obvious and that can be a turnoff to, you know, this particular market that we're going for. Mm-hmm. So I would shy away from that realm, not out of a sense of it's inferior. It's just, it's not what's happening this time. Right. And that's something that we can explore further in the future.
Yeah, so genre-wise, as long as anything's notated, I think that is the significant thing. I think I'm sort of leaning some more in that, or at least a kind of a theatrical pop kind of direction. But it's as long as it's you've got a notation, then it's coherent with anything else and can be used in the same purpose of teacher at the piano, mm-hmm. or performer at the piano playing off a score, and then what that the stylistic context of that is might be different. But that's I mean, I've been taught mostly out of books like that, mm-hmm. Of musical theatre, but is the vast majority of the teaching I've happened to have has come from someone at the piano playing off a pop musical or a musical theatre selection, mm-hmm. book. And in many ways, I think that's something in that direction, particularly where it's contemporary in the voice and piano, although a voice mold, because there's always going to be work along though for that is going to be taking influences from contemporary balladry and pop or musical theatre spheres, whatever that might happen to mean. I think that's it's almost an obvious notation, and I think that one of the things that having that sort of stylistic reference, it makes a sort of a way in, a selling of
things
for some singers. I know that I've had conversation with this with Maren and a couple of others on Twitter not long ago, along exactly those lines, in terms of like a lot easier to sell to some particularly younger students in terms of it's like musical theatre rather than it's like opera, even if they might deal with the same sort of issues and potentially be sung in a not that dissimilar way.
David, do you think I can jump in here and ask Dennis a question about what I think some composers might feel that because maybe Laura and I sing lots of extended technique kind of stuff, mm-hmm. if that's going to be a consideration for part of this. Can you talk about if composers are writing from different influences, you know, that would be open, or, you know, how that might factor into what we're thinking curator-wise?
Yeah, I think extended techniques are cool and totally, you know, interesting to explore for this.
But not necessary.
It's totally not necessary. If that's what you have and that's what you think is your best work, that's what we want to see is your best work. And, you know, if it's not a part of this one, we're planning on doing more. So, you know,
what if somebody's writing in a more traditional style, a la, you know, like more Richard Hundley or something? Like,
yeah, you know. Totally. Like there's such a, there's a desire for the whole range of things. I mean, I've been reaching out to voice teachers for the better part of a year now, talking about some of this stuff and talking about my music. And I've had some of them ask me, like, where do I find stuff? You know, looking, one teacher asked specifically, like, about stuff with electronics. So mm-hmm. they're looking for that. Extended techniques, totally. None of that? Yeah. Like, there's a lot of singers out there who don't want to go, like, crazy extended techniques or even any extended techniques. They don't want to do improvisation. They don't want to do electronics. They don't want to go into these places where, like, we live. But they do want to, they want that entree. So we're gonna try to serve as many masters here as possible.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know about you, Megan, but I have kind of thought through, I've been giving a lot of thought this fall to what, to me, makes a compelling song, and how I can look through these pieces that will come from very different points of view and possibly points of view that I am not as familiar with, and try to be as objective as possible. Like, mm-hmm. what makes a song important and mm-hmm. worthy of, you know, being elevated above another song? And I'm trying real hard to get myself into a mental space of being open to being comfortable with things that aren't necessarily in my wheelhouse, because mm-hmm. I don't want to discriminate against something that's truly worthy mm-hmm. just because it's not what I'm used to doing. So, you know, I've kind of, this is this is something I don't think any of us are going into lightly. And I think we're all like very like serious that we are trying very hard not to discriminate against anything.
And
we want to be open, and we want to find the best representations of what's happening right now, whatever that may be.
Yeah. And one thing that I really foresee for the future of these, you know, I mean, we'll have multiple rounds of soprano, mezzo, tenor, baritone. I'm not going to, well, you know, after this round, I'm going to step back as the tenor curator. Like, it's just easier for me to be the tenor this time, but I will want another approach to tenor rep next time. And so I see the curators like rotating, like, you know, I'm not like firing you guys like in before things have started, but you know, because you'll come back for more. But but like I do want a rotation.
A lot of work. I don't think I could do it more than once a year.
I know, right? Well, there will be a different schedule. It won't be like a new round every year.
I know, I'm just joking.
but yeah, like I do want multiple points of view, so we will have like different curatorial points of view in every anthology, so that, you know, maybe, you know, maybe I have certain biases in my brain. I know I do, you know, like I'll be fighting them, but maybe like the stuff in the tenor anthology this time is much more like, okay, this is more in my wheelhouse, and that's kind of where I'm going to live, because I think that that's going to be what's best for this volume. Next time I'm going to pick another tenor who's going to have a different approach, so that the tenor stuff that was submitted this time that didn't get selected has a totally new chance, you know, like the New Music USA project grants, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, like totally.
I wonder if Laura, since you mentioned thinking about this objectively, if you had any thoughts about some of those objective qualities that you're thinking about as you're going into this curatorial process, what are some of those things?
Sure. And I want to hear yours too, because it's still an evolving thought process. But I think one thing is text, and what text has been chosen, and then how the composer responds to that text.
Mm-hmm.
How to put this? I don't know. I always start with the text. Like when I'm looking through a book of songs or whatever, trying to find rep, if I can't connect with the text, then I have a very hard time connecting with the music.
Yeah.
No matter how good. So that's one thing. So I'm going to start there. Mm-hmm. But I'm also going to pull back from there, because sometimes a really great song might be hidden to me because of my own biases, but you know, I may not love the text, but the song is truly great. So I'll pull back and say, okay, so I judged it harshly because I didn't like these words, but why? And why did they choose them? Like, how did they sculpt the music around this? Like, what made them choose these words? It's kind of like reading a novel. You feel like you get to know a writer based on what they've written, and you may have like the completely wrong idea about who they are as a person, but they kind of told you in a way, like what kind of person they are by what they chose to write about, how they wrote it. And it's the same for a song. So you kind of,
do you think
it's a lot in
looking for some of that also text setting, not just the words themselves, but how those words are set, like along a vocal line, would be an important thing as well that we're probably all looking for.
Exactly. Then, exactly. So like where the words take the composer. And I mean, maybe someone will submit a vocalese.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. You know, so then like, is there a melodic hook that just, I once this composer in my undergrad wrote a one act opera for scenes. And that melody has never left me to this day, like to this day, I could sing the line to you.
Right. So can we put a little like thought in here that is like, singers love melodies. If you've got a bomb ass melody, sorry. If you've got a bomb melody, like put it in there. Like that, like think about your scores that have really great melodies. And that's maybe something that would really catch our eyes and ears. Like,
yeah. Yeah, and that's not to say that some great music doesn't have a melodic hook, but if you've got one, and it's out, and it's just, you know, that's, you're right. That's like the immediate way to just like capture our souls.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think I'm also looking for thoughts about texture. Mm-hmm. So like how it's written with, if it's a voice and piano score, if you're writing for, is it like this piano feature and the voice is just kind of there, or have you thought about how those two instruments work together? There's mm-hmm. a lot of that collaborative idea
yeah.
that I would be very interested in. So if composers are kind of listening to this part and thinking about like, oh, okay, what do I have that's really compelling?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be another area that I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and like little things, little technical things, like if I'm as a soprano, if I'm singing at the bottom of the staff and the piano is like at forte and like super loud and high, big, you're not going to hear me.
Mm-hmm.
So like little things like, do you know that? Has that composer thought of that? You know, and maybe that's what yeah. he wants. But I'll know based on what he's, whether or not he realizes that he's done that or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Or whether it was on purpose.
So those are some of those kind of singerly things I think mm-hmm. that we're kind of thinking about as we're going into this call for scores mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah,
Dennis, did you have any curator thoughts from your side about like that, this is kind of a branch off of that genre discussion, or like yeah. what do you feel like you're like, yeah, that makes me feel really good?
Yeah, I think it, for me, like, yeah, melody, I like melody, but I mean a lot of good songs don't do that thing. But I can tell if it's well written.
Yeah.
You know, and it will, if it's well written, it will most likely speak to me. So, you know, yeah, I'm looking for people who know how to use the voice, who understand who understand text setting, prosody, you know, if I'm a composer who works really closely with the text, I'm all about heightening the natural rhythm of the text. If you're a composer who does the opposite of that and you can show me that you know what you're doing, great. You know,
yeah.
I just want well-written stuff,
yeah.
basically. It comes down to, like, put your best foot forward. I this will brings us into, like, I'll ask you guys, one of the composers, she asked, is there a preference to how I choose my songs? Are you looking for contrasting styles? Are you looking for different difficulty levels? Like, should she like give you like for, you know, like one kind of faster, crazier piece and then one slower, more lyrical? Or is there, do you have any preference for what you get from a composer? I know what my answer is.
I know what my answer is. Meg, do you want to?
I think we all have the okay. same answer.
Everybody's like, I know.
I know.
No, I know what my answer is. I know what my answer is, but I didn't want to like, I feel like I'm like talking too much.
No, you're not at all. So I think that our point is submit whatever you want, like whatever you mm-hmm. think is your best work that you think is mm-hmm. the most compelling. And we would, the curating side is going to be like, oh, I really like this. If it's a really difficult mm-hmm. piece, I might still put it in there because I want, that would be like this side of it. And then I'm also going to put a very straightforward piece in there or something like that, because as long as they're all compelling, mm-hmm. you don't have to only put in one difficulty level, because I'm not marketing this to only, preteen mm-hmm. classical singers or something like
yeah.
that. That would not, you know, so that, or you don't have to show me a range of styles, you just mm-hmm. have to put forth what you think are the things that make you go, heck yes,
yeah.
this is my voice. Like,
yeah, I guarantee you that if I get two songs by one composer and I've got them in front of me, I'm not saying, well, they submitted this really hard one
mm-hmm.
and they yeah. submitted this simple one. You know, I'm looking for the best thing.
Yeah.
So I always say in any competition, like when I talk to young singers about competitions, don't try to game the judges.
Mm-hmm.
Don't right. try to get in there, because you can't know what they had for lunch
no.
or how hot the room is.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you're the singer or the first singer, just sing what you sing best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So composers, give us what you love. Give
yes.
us what you think represents who you are, and that we're going to appreciate that so much. Because the other thing that I always tell singers is like, judges want to love you. Like,
yeah.
I'm not sitting here trying to look at scores and like, oh, look what this dumb person did, you know? Like, I want to have this be the hardest decision I've ever made in my life, because
yeah.
everything is so amazing. I'm dying.
Yeah. 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 Like, if you, for me, like, just put your best foot forward. Whatever you think is your best work, that's what I want. If what you send in, like your best work, is something that's hard, great, like that's what I want. Or if it's some, if it's like Ned Roram's I Am Rose, like, by the way, if you don't know that song, look it up. Like I will choose I Am Rose any day. Yeah. Because it's amazing, not because it's like super simple, but because it's a really beautifully crafted song. Something that's super hard, like if it's well crafted.
Like, another point, and that might be text, that I'm not, I don't think any of us are shying away from difficult subject matter in a text. Maybe just think about it, if that's part of it, if it feels gratuitous in that way, then that, like, that's just, that's not a solid choice. But like that, you don't have to send things that are like palatable because it's going in an anthology, like whatever that means to you, feel free to pick something that you connect with emotionally, that other people would also connect with emotionally. It doesn't have to be like, it can only be contemporary thoughts, or it can only be really anachronistic thoughts, whatever.
Yeah. And we're all like, okay, the guy who's running the show here runs the music publishing podcast, which has an explicit rating for a reason. All of the curators are adults. We're marketing this to professional singers, you know, who we know singers, to, you know, to their adult team. What's that?
We want to give interesting recitals. Yeah. About, you know, like.
Yeah. And like. Yeah,
and that also means that subject matter can be broad, because people are making recitals that are about more than just like nature. So, but if you write something about nature, that's totally fine too.
Oh yeah. 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 Like they're beautiful. Yeah.
No, but we don't.
Yeah. Your submissions can be, you know.
We're going to get Greenpeace on our butts.
Yeah. If the subject matter is like very broad and traditional, great. If it's more political, great. If, you know, like on contemporary themes or a particular like kind of difficult subject matter, if the song is well written, that's the thing. Because the people who are going to be like consuming this are adults.
Yeah. That's... Can we also talk about another point, though, I don't know, Megan, but
And please feel free to disagree with me, but I'm having the thought that sometimes things can be too topical. So, like, we are doing this anthology, you know, hopefully for something that will last for, you know, this can be something that can last. I mean, every song should be able to be sung in 10 years and people will still know what you're talking about. Yeah. So maybe, you know, like, don't do, like, Melissa McCarthy doing her Sean Spicer impersonation, because...
Yeah. That's a big...
In 10 years, you know, like... Yeah. Like, there's a song I sing by a composer where he like references this like bizarre murder story that was in the news in the 1980s. And I had no idea what I was singing about. And I asked him, I was like, oh yeah, when I wrote this song, this was like in the news and everybody was talking about it. I was like, oh, you know, it was like, so it's fine, but just try to think timeless. You can be compelling and current and timeless.
Yeah. Yeah. There's timely, and then there's like something that can last.
Logistically, can we talk about text? Do texts need to be like public domain? How do you make sure that that's taken care of?
Well, so let's talk some business here, folks.
We gotta get down to it, because I can't be here for much longer, sadly.
Okay. So texts can be, you know, public domain. They can be, you know, under copyright. You as the composer, okay, let's assume that you are self-published. That means like when you get your royalty, and we'll talk about the royalties in a second here. When you get your royalty, you have to honor your agreement with the poet if they are living and you know, have an agreement with them. If the text is public domain, hey, you don't have to split it with anybody. But if you have a 50-50 split with your poet, that's on you. You have to like split your royalties with them. That's your agreement with them, not mine. If you are with a traditional publisher, you need to talk to them and get permission first in order to submit, because if you submit and don't have permission, that's on you. I'm assuming that you have permission to do this, that you are either the copyright holder or that you have permission from the copyright holder. And if you have an outside publisher, you are not the copyright holder, probably. So get permission, not forgiveness. So The thing I've heard so far from the one composer that I know absolutely who has a traditional publisher, they told her, so long as your texts are in the public domain, we're fine, so that we don't have to pay out more money for that. So if you have a traditional publisher, think about that. If you're self-published and you don't want to deal with royalties, think about that. Just know that somebody's going to have to pay the poets, and it's either you or your outside publisher. It's not like...
And there are some poets that won't let you set their stuff. So know that too.
Yeah. Like, well, and hopefully at this point, the songs are already written, so you don't have to deal with that.
Well, I know composers who've written something on a poem they found compelling, and then they found out they couldn't.
So yeah. You need to have an agreement in place with your poet. And once things get to a point where we've narrowed things down, I will be going out to everybody and making sure that you have all of your permissions in place, because I don't want to get on the bad side of anybody, and you don't want to get on the bad side of anybody. So let's make sure that there are no lawsuits here.
Don't let Dr. Seuss, man. His estate will take you down.
Oh, I know. Yeah. None of that. So I guess while we're on the subject of royalties and business stuff, real quick, sort of here's how the royalties are basically going to work. So the anthologies right now, this is all subject to some change, but basically I'm probably going to price it at $24.99, which is totally affordable for a young singer. And everything will have to come out of that. So there are a couple of upfront costs that are going to come out of that before royalties get calculated. If the anthology gets sold through the New Music Shelf website, which it probably will, there's the transaction fee that comes from the payment processor that will come out. Then reasonable production expenses like printing and binding costs, which are really low, which is amazing. Certain post-production things like buying the UPC, I'm going to amortize that across the first print run, and that will come out of the first batch, and then that will actually go away after we do a second print run, if we do one, which I think we will. Then the curator royalties are actually upfront costs. It will be a flat rate for the curators. Once we hit those expenses, there might be one or two tiny ones in there that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. That's the pool that we split in half. Half of that stays with New Music Shelf to make sure that we can do the next rounds of these. And the other half will be split amongst the composers for that volume. So there will be 20 songs per volume. So final half will get split 20 ways. According to my current calculations, which actually bump up production costs and sort of bump up the expenses on the front end, so it looks like the royalties will be smaller than they really are, though they could be more accurate. Right now, it's looking like royalties are going to be about 50 cents per copy of the anthology sold. So if you have one song in an anthology, every copy of the anthology that gets sold, you're going to make about 50 cents. That I don't know the exact production costs for printing and binding, but I have a really good sense. So that may actually go up by a few cents. So that's what we're looking at for the money for the anthologies. Laura mentioned earlier that, two of the extra... The extra sort of perks that come with this, I want to have. We've all talked about having performances of the anthologies. You know, one sort of concert per anthology. If we have to break it up into two because it's a little long, that's fine. We'll do that. Hopefully here in New York City, and we'll do a live recording of that will be available for you for your. You can put that on your website. You can use it as, marketing for your own work. We're going to be really generous with that. You just aren't going to be able to sell it. And we're not going to sell that either. That will just be reference for us and for people who need to hear it. Then we're going to go into the studio, each of us, and we're going to record each anthology as a companion CD. So most like a lot of these anthologies and things that come out, there's a companion recording that comes with it so that singers can learn it much more easily. They can hear what it sounds like. They can judge what's going on. We're going to do that. you're going to have singers, you know, people who buy it are going to have the option to buy that as a bundle, or they can buy it separately, and it will just be its own album out on iTunes. You will earn a royalty on every one of those that is sold. It will be the compulsory license rate of, you know, 9.1 cents or 1.0 cents per minute over 5 minutes. So you have a sense
of... Can
I ask
you a question? Yeah. Okay, so I gather the one of the main groups, the target audience for this anthology would be teachers mm-hmm. and, of course, also students.
Mm-hmm.
Would it make sense from a business point of view to also release a recording of only the instrumental part so that people can...
That's something that's like, definitely...
karaoke?
Yes, that's absolutely okay. Something that I'm interested in doing as well. That will be... I'm figuring out the logistics of that right now. But okay. that is something like students are going to need a backing track. I got this suggestion a while ago from my sister-in-law, who's a voice teacher.
Okay, perfect.
So yeah, that'll be a thing.
In that case, fine, because I don't want to hog the discussion too long. I just wanted to mention this as an idea.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a thing.
So another thing I want to just already said it, but I'm not a native speaker, so I have to a little bit. Do you require an investment from the participating composers?
No, that's the other thing that I wanted to talk about. So there's no application to... What's that?
Is it perfect timing?
I know, it's perfect. Yeah, there's no fee to apply, obviously. Once it comes down to when your song is selected, there's no investment to be a part of the thing. What will happen?
Okay.
Once it comes time for the recording, we will ask composers, but not in any way even remotely require. But we will ask that each composer helps us to raise a couple $100 a piece to help defray sure. our costs for the recording. And right now, what I'm looking at for projected expenses is probably each composer we're going to ask that they raise like $300. So that's like asking Perfect. A dozen friends and family for $25. That will, so I've already thought about that because I, you know, I'm thinking, you know, me as a composer, what do I, you know, what's going to be easy for me? And the recordings will not be put out through New Music Shelf, but they'll be put out by another company that I have called Perfect Enemy Records, which is a record label, and it is becoming a nonprofit by the end. Well, I'm applying for nonprofit status very, very soon. So I'll also be working with a fiscal sponsor just to make sure that everything's kosher. But those donations will be tax deductible. So if your parents want to pitch in, you know, $50, they get a write-off on their taxes. So that's a part of that to make that sweeter for everybody else.
Okay, perfect. Thank
Yay.
You.
Sweet. I think we've covered most. One thing. I've had some people say like, "Oh, I have." I really only have song cycles. Like this one's 5 songs long. That one's 9. Is that not eligible? Here's what I want. I want you to excerpt those song cycles. I would much rather that you submit, and I think you guys agree, that we'd sort of much rather have you submit something. I mean, submit your best work, period. You know, if your best work happens to be in the middle of a song cycle, I say that's all the better. Because I would really love to have all 20 songs, well, actually all 80 songs, have above the title from such and such song cycle. So that the singers, as they say, I love this song, I love performing this song. Oh, look, it's from a larger set. Let me go look that up. I want this to be advertisement for the rest of your catalog. And that's why this one... big publisher in particular is happy to be involved because it's marketing for their catalog too. So nice. if your work is excerpted from a larger thing, just make sure that song stands alone, you know?
Sure.
I think have we gone through, one little technical thing. You don't have to separate out a voice part with vocal music. You don't do that. It's not like, instrumental music, don't worry about that. Just voice and piano, all on one
score
thing. Yeah. Megan, Laura, is there anything else you want to add in here? before we, because I think we've covered everything. We've gone over an hour. Yay.
Yeah. No, I think those are the questions that I was getting. So I think I covered, you know, my responsibility to the people that ask me.
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't really talk about language really quickly. Can we do a quick rundown?
Yeah.
We talked about, is it okay to have more than just English?
Yeah. Megan, I'm going to, you helped to clarify that for me, so I'm going to let you take that one.
Oh, shoot. I think that what we said was, you know, that this is kind of language. We sing in lots of different languages and it doesn't really matter. And like, it's a great opportunity for us to like practice this. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. And that if at all possible, if you would like to include IPA for anything that is not a standard singing language or kind of like the big, you know, three or four that we kind of think of, if you want to include that, that's always helpful.
Yeah.
More helpful materials are always appreciated, but not necessary. And I don't think that any of us are upset about having like new contemporary art song that it is citizens of the world.
Yeah. So, yeah. Just,
if you could supply a translation though, just a translation off to the side so that we don't have to do the translation work ourselves as we're trying to figure out what your poetry is about.
Yeah. Yeah. That can be, if it's not a part of your score file, just pop in an extra PDF or something with the text in it, the translation, so that we know. Don't worry about putting an extra cover page and all the front material and back material. If you're excerpting from something, just slice it out of the file, drop in the PDF of just the music. That's fine. All of this, actually, it's going to be re-engraved to be a part of the New Music Shelf house style. So just present your music well. Don't worry about a cover and all of that. That's not going to end up being a thing.
Well, I have one more question, which I think wasn't covered yet. Maybe it was mentioned, if so, apologies. But is there like recommended duration for the song?
Yeah, under 10 minutes.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, beyond that, it just starts to get a little unwieldy.
It was actually in the application format. I remember now. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah. I think that covers everything. So I guess the last thing to say is, please apply. The more music, the merrier. Let people know about this. Again, the more music, the merrier. If your music isn't chosen, it's not about you. It's not about your music. It's not about your piece. We hope to get a crazy, crazy number of submissions. We're getting a lot already. I want a lot more. This isn't a one and done, hopefully. I really don't want this to be like, okay, we did this once, the end. As a composer, I apply to opportunities in quotes, fairly regularly, and
this is not an opportunity in quotes.
Yeah, this is not the typical.
This is an actual opportunity.
Yeah, it's not like we got 100 submissions, we chose one, we performed it once, it was under rehearsed, and then that's the end. Maybe we got you a live recording, but probably we forgot about it, and then that's the end of our relationship.
None of that.
There is nothing here that we want to resemble that even remotely. We're picking 80 songs to be published. Oh, speaking of published, we're not taking your copyright. You maintain the copyright. That's really important. You continue to do whatever you want to do with that song. There's no copyright transference here. We're going to perform it probably just once live, and we're going to give you a live recording, but we're also going to go into the studio and we're going to make a recording, and you're going to get royalties on all of this. We're not going to ask you to waive any rights, waive any fees throughout any of this, as so many opportunities do as a composer. That pisses me off. I get so angry when I see those things, and I don't want to do that.
So win, 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 win all around.
Yeah,
right?
that's what I want. I want wins all around. And if anybody has more questions, comments, suggestions, you can reach out to any of us. But the central hub for this is New Music Shelf. So newmusicshelf@gmail.com is my central mailbox for these things. Reach out. I want to make sure that your submissions are great and fit what we're looking for. And I want your music to be a part of this stuff.
Yay.
So yay. Thank you everybody for being here.
Thanks for hosting this, Dennis.
Yeah. I look forward to putting this out there and having more people know about it. So, yeah, thank you. Hooray.
All right. Well, I will see you guys hopefully soon. You know? And people are welcome to write me questions if they feel like it, if that's okay with you, Dennis.
I mean, the only reason why I sort of say, like, send him to me is so that I'm I don't mind being bothered. I'm sure you don't mind being bothered either, but to have a central thing that's not like flooding everybody. But if you're anybody willing to take questions, can take questions.
Sure. And you can also like send, questions to Dennis and he can funnel them out to us if it's.
Yeah. Any questions that come to me that aren't like things that I can just pop off really easily. I absolutely reach out to everybody else and get input. So it's not just, me making decisions by fiat. Right.
Wonderful. Okay.
Cool. Thank you all. Bye.
Bye.